Hello, and welcome to episode 82 of the History of Yugoslav Football podcast, When Three Become One, Part 2. In this episode, we'll end Bosnia in our timeline, dropping them off in the early 2010s as the national side would reach their peak, and as FIFA and UEFA would contrive the final bureaucratic change that would set the nation onto a path of footballing irrelevance. We spent much of the last episode talking about formats, be that formats for the progression towards a single national league, or formats for the progression towards a modern nation state. This time, we'll be focusing on the national team and on one key development within the Bosnian FA that set the scene for Bosnia to be where it is today, and perhaps encapsulates well the problems of having a state like Bosnia in the first place. To begin that, we must start in the Republika Srpska. At the end of the Bosnian War, Bosnia-Herzegovina was in three distinct entities. But while the Bosniak and Croat areas worked together and were reasonably united, the Republika Srpska was anything but. In the couple of years after the war, divisions internally rose up rapidly and split the political life of the region in two. One side, the Palais Group under Radovan Karadzic, who was officially out of office, but still massively powerful, and on the other, the Banja Luka Group under Biljana Plavsic, and the figure who would soon dominate Republika Srpska politics and does so to this day, Milorad Dodik. Biljana Plavsic became president of Republika Srpska, replacing Karadzic after Dayton, ostensibly because Karadzic thought that she could be controlled. Karadzic was emphatically wrong to think that. Plavsic embarked upon a number of inflammatory moves that sparked a crisis in the Republika Srpska, moving the capital from Palais to Banja Luka, severing ties with Slobodan Milosevic, and working with the US to solidify the peace. She would nominate the then pretty insignificant Dodik as Prime Minister and start his political life in earnest. Plavsic's role in sidelining totally Karadzic and moving his career out of politics and solely into being on the run for war crimes would cost her her own career, and it would not really be until the presidency of Mirko Saric from 2000 that things in the region would truly settle down. Saric and Dodik would be the first politicians to be, in essence, new men, with little to no connection to the pre-war realities, and even less to the very real war crimes of the 1990s. As for Plavsic, she would plea bargain with the international courts and be sentenced to 11 years in prison for crimes against humanity. During the war, Plavsic had been arguably the most extreme of the Republika Srpska's political class, one thing that certainly did endear her to Karadzic, describing Muslims as, quote, genetically deformed material, and would describe the ethnic cleansing of the war as, quote, a natural phenomenon. In the aftermath of the war, even those who played their part in solidifying the peace could not escape their crimes of their role in war. Given that Dodik remains the dominant political figure in the region, it's worth just focusing on him for a moment in spite of the fact that most of his controversies will come after our timeline for Bosnia draws to a close. Dodik rose to prominence because he was a moderate, and because he was seen as shedding the Republika Srpska's wartime worries. Since then, he has progressively moved towards the nationalism his politics was meant to replace. His second term as Prime Minister from 2006 was based around his policy of being all things to all people, playing to the nationalists at home while playing to the international community to get funding for the region. That mask pretty quickly slipped, and from 2008 it'd be fair to say that there's pretty universal acceptance that Dodik is one of the more extreme nationalist politicians in the region, and by quite some considerable distance the most powerful one. It is fair to accuse him of genocide denial with regard to his opinions around Srebrenica, and it is fair to accuse him of attempting to make his Republika Srpska as close to an independent or autonomous state as he could possibly get away with. He is also the uncle of the current Bosnian FA president, Vico Zeljkovic, and, while we won't get around to Zeljkovic in this episode, in the Bosnia primer that's coming alongside this episode, we'll be talking about Vico quite a bit. The important takeaway from all that stuff in the Republika Srpska is simply to show that while Bosnia is one state, destabilizing forces are very much cooked into it, and that the national team and the wider FA in general have been part of that rhetorical battlefield. This matters quite a bit, because before we get into the national team, we'll talk about the development that was impacted by this. With the unity of the Bosnian FA that came with the combination of the leagues at the end of the last episode, came the traditional arrangement around how national associations were run in Bosnia. Specifically, there was a rotating presidency which included members from all three ethnic communities. In autumn 2010, both FIFA and UEFA contacted the Bosnian FA to state that this was no longer acceptable and that the FA must be led by one person alone. Now, in the defence of FIFA and UEFA in this particular point, between 2002 and 2010, the NFSBIH wasn't exactly run well, and arguably that was a direct result of the tripartite system in place, which saw fan boycotts, anti-FA banners and occasional player boycotts also. The problem that the tripartite system had cooked in was that, as we discussed in the previous episode with the clubs that were included in the three-pronged Bosnian league system, the talent pool within the country, particularly in certain regions, was such that the ethnic splits didn't create strong enough clubs to survive on their own. With the pool of clubs with which to get footballing experience in administration, etc., so shallow, there weren't enough competent people to run the FA properly, and people were in key positions because of ethnicity rather than their competence or appropriateness. An issue that reached its height when Milan Jelic became head of the FA. Milan Jelic, an extremely competent politician, was an extremely good business mind and a very forceful promoter of sport, but he was holding the role of head of the FA as a job share alongside his other job of being the president of Republika Srpska, which unsurprisingly took up most of his time and attention. After the FA were originally unable to find agreement on a way to move things to a single member presidency, UEFA and FIFA would impose a short international ban on Bosnia-Herzegovina, one which was overturned with the creation of a normalisation committee to bring a new structure into place, primarily led by Avice Osim. At the end of 2012, the work of that would be complete with the election of Elvidin Begic as head of the FA, who would stick in the role for over 8 years. Begic was a fine administrator, but to direct us back to the companion episode coming out alongside all this, forcing three to become one in this instance may have improved some elements of Bosnia's footballing governance, but also left it far more open to abuse if the wrong person was in charge of things. That sort of debate was, of course, rather a long way off when Bosnia first started playing as a national team. During the war itself, a Bosnian select side would play travelling games against club teams and, perhaps most notably, gain a win over Iran in Tehran in June 1993, and a German-based Bosnian diaspora touring side would also play against clubs. While at this point there was no unified single Bosnia side, unlike the Hungarian Golden Team touring after that country's revolution in the 50s, there was at least something that could put itself together on short notice to play games. So it was then that just 9 days after the signature of Dayton, a side officially representing the Republic of Bosnia and Herzegovina played under a provisional membership from FIFA in a friendly against Albania. The side that played that opening international game was basically a Bosniak side, arranging a game on short notice outside of a normal international break and having to get to Albania by travelling via Zagreb because they couldn't take the direct route southwards through Serbia, for obvious reasons. The entire squad consisted of 11 players total, and they would play not in an official kit but in whatever they could get on short notice from sports shops in Zagreb. Husref Mosemic would come out of retirement to play in the game, lasting a half, and Bosnia would, perhaps unsurprisingly, given all these circumstances, lose 2-0. While that game has taken almost a legendary status in terms of its ramshackle nature, the point was made that Bosnia had been able to put a team out and play as a nation. Becoming one that was competitive could wait a little bit for a side that were primarily there to prove to FIFA that they were just ready to enter international competitions in the first place. And they proved that particular point, earning themselves a slot in qualifying for the 1998 World Cup. Just under a year after earning that slot, they would put themselves on the map in November 96 with their first victories. Firstly, a 2-1 win in Sarajevo in a friendly over World Cup runners-up Italy, followed swiftly by a 2-1 win in Ljubljana for their first competitive win over Slovenia. But while we sit in the 2020s, with Bosnia as a pretty established national side, if not currently a very good one, it took them time to establish themselves on the international stage. 2003 would be the first time they had a winning year, including turning over both Denmark and Norway in Euro 2004 qualifying, but only ending up fourth in a tight and low-quality group. Realistically, it wouldn't be till some time later, until 2007, that Bosnia-Herzegovina became in any way, shape or form good. And even that was not really by design. As we mentioned earlier, one of the reactions to the tripartite leadership system was player boycotts, and in 2006, specifically in the autumn, it would see the largest of those, and as a result, Bosnia were forced to push players into the squad to fill gaps. 2007 would see the international debuts of Edin Dzeko and Vidar Dibisevic, numbers 1 and 2 on the list of all-time goal scorers for the side, with the following year seeing debuts for Miljan Pjanic, who would have been called up in 2007 had there not been a passport issue, and also Sinad Lulic. The previous generation stepping aside, in many cases due to disillusionment, would create the opening for Bosnia's golden generation to begin their journey. The World Cup 2006 qualifying campaign which preceded that had arguably augured well for the following decade of European football. Serbia and Montenegro topped that group unbeaten before a disastrous World Cup itself, but it was the three teams behind them that were on the cusp of something. Spain was second in what would be the final tournament before they embraced tiki-taka and took over international football. Belgium were in their final World Cup campaign before their golden generation began to take over, and Bosnia were awaiting their first golden generation also. So on the face of it, that immediately Bosnia finished that campaign and lost arguably their two best, or certainly their two most prominent players in Hasan Salihamidzic, who had scored the nation's first ever goal, and also captain Sergei Barbares, in one go, didn't raise hopes as to their chances going forward. And if we're honest, the 2008 qualifying campaign for the Euros wasn't an especially good one, with Bosnia far off the group's top three of Greece, Turkey and Norway. But as a campaign based around blooding the next generation, the following campaign would have shown 2008 to be a resounding success, with 2010 World Cup qualification beginning with holding Spain to only 1-0 when the Spanish were at their very peak, then battering Estonia 7-0. And to lead them through this period would be one person we've come across a couple of times before on the podcast, Ciro Blažević. Ciro was very much a panic hire at this point, after previous manager Miho Kotro was sacked for refusing to take part in a friendly against Iran. And I think, if you know your more recent history, Miho Kodro doesn't have a very good run of luck when it comes to being national team manager. With fans unsurprisingly annoyed at the disarray that the FA's decision to attempt to play the Islamic Republic had caused, Ciro wasn't a popular hire at the time, particularly given his previous links to Croatian nationalism. However, true to form, Ciro would charm the pants off people and then fall out with them. Results did the talking, and in a strong group against Turkey and Belgium as well as Spain, Bosnia reached the playoffs to face Portugal. While Portugal would win both legs 1-0, and Blažević would leave the job straight after, having fallen out with the squad over criticism of players in the wake of the playoff loss. But in under 18 months in the role, Blažević had done everything he needed to. The players who needed experience got it. The confidence the team needed was earned. The fans were gradually brought on side, and Bosnia-Herzegovina began to look like a very good team indeed. The problem they kept having, however, was they kept on landing in groups with sides just a step higher than them. For 2010, it was Spain. For Euro 2012, it would be France. And, under Safet Susic now, a repeat of the pain of 2010. Getting into the playoffs, meeting up with Portugal, keeping things pretty competitive over the two legs, but eventually succumbing. Qualification for the 2014 World Cup was to be different. Greece and Slovakia were their two main competitors in the group, and Slovakia more or less ruled their chances out by falling out of the blocks, having started poorly, meaning that once more it would be a case of first or second for Bosnia. A win over Greece in March 2013 gave them the head-to-head over the Greeks, and they were further helped by a massively superior goal difference. Edin Džeko was the second top scorer in all of UEFA qualifying, with Ibisevic third. At the conclusion of the qualifying campaign, they would be 13th in the FIFA World Rankings, which, while I think as any fan would appreciate, is hardly an accurate barometer of a side, it gives you an impression of the sort of company the Bosnian national side was being spoken of in the same breath as. Having not landed with a torturously difficult qualifying draw, it was only to be expected that having qualified, they would get a torturously difficult group stage draw for the World Cup in Brazil. Landing in a group with eventual runners-up Argentina, reigning African champions Nigeria, and World Cup regulars in Iran. Debuting at the Maracanã, near full with Argentina fans making the comparatively short hop across the border, Bosnia-Herzegovina no doubt hoped to keep things tighter against the wealth of attacking talent Argentina had. Instead, 2 minutes and 9 seconds into the game, a Messi free kick was flicked on by Marcos Rojo down onto the legs of Sead Kolasinac and bounced past Asmir Begovic for the fastest own goal in World Cup history. In truth, save for a Romero save from a corner close to the end of the first half, the game was reduced to a series of half chances, until Argentina doubled their lead through Messi with a very Messi sort of wonder goal on 65 minutes, dancing around the defence, playing a 1-2 with Higuain, and then belting it in low from the edge of the box. Ibisevic would keep it interesting, scoring Bosnia's first World Cup goal with 6 minutes to play, sliding it scuffily under Romero from an angle, but things were always more likely to go 3-1 than 2-2. It was an expected, a routine loss, but it was one where Bosnia would come out of it with their heads held high. What would happen in their next game, however, was anything but routine. In the 22nd minute of Bosnia's game against Nigeria, Edin Džeko was played in behind the Nigerian defence as F.A. Ambrose hung back from the rest of the defensive line. Džeko, as normal, finished with aplomb, but the linesman's flag went up. Replays showed Džeko was not just onside, but onside by quite some distance. 7 minutes later, Peter Odemwingie would score the only goal of the game. Bosnia-Herzegovina would fashion chances, mainly from crosses, with Džeko coming closest, seeing a shot saved by Enyama onto the post in second half injury time. While, obviously, to describe it as a robbery would suggest an issue of conspiracy rather than competence, FIFA did seize the referee's computer and phone to check for match fixing after the game, although nothing was found. The referee, Kiwi Peter O'Leary, did later admit the decision was the wrong one, and that he simply relied on the erroneous judgment of his linesman. Given that 2014 was the last World Cup before VAR was introduced, nothing could be done to correct it, although, let's be honest, if the Kiwi officiating team had done their job correctly that day in Cuiabá, then maybe we wouldn't have had to have VAR in the first place. Wouldn't that be a wonderful world? Bosnia's final game of the group stage was a dead rubber against Iran, with the Nigerian nonsense having already eliminated them. But the game in Salvador offered a chance for redemption. With nothing on the line, Bosnia battered Iran, as the Iranians needed to attack and to win to keep their tournament alive. Dzeko would have something to say about that, opening the scoring with a low left-footed strike from 25 yards. Definitely onside. Pjanic would score the second after a high turnover allowed Tino Sven Susic, who is related to Safet Susic, is his nephew, in fact, to thread him through on goal. While Iran would pull one back, Visijevic would add gloss to the win almost immediately after, and Bosnia would finish with a 3-1 win to round off their tournament. They have not qualified for a major tournament since, but have made unsuccessful playoff appearances in that time, and are in the playoffs for Euro 2024, although I think, as we'll get to in the companion episode, I think we'll probably can prejudge that one as being another one of the unsuccessful playoff appearances, most likely. Domestically, football settled into a routine of four major clubs dominating. Sarajevo and Zvezdnikar, as the two big Sarajevo clubs, with Zrinjski Mostar and Borac Banjaluka joining in from time to time. Issues did happen. In 2006-2007, Zrinjski walked off the pitch in protest at the refereeing of a game against Orasje. The footage of this does exist on YouTube under a video from 2007 called Football in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and if you want to have a laugh, then I thoroughly recommend watching it, given it lists 14 separate wrong decisions from the game, favouring Orasje, beginning with a brutal foul, not carded, just 2 seconds into the game. Similar happened with iffy refereeing in a game between Soroki Brieg and Celik Cinic also. These weren't their only thing. These weren't isolated issues. And they were not isolated issues of the sort of refereeing standard that would put a New Zealand officiating team to shame. Zrinjski would be docked points for their actions in that particular game. The following season would see Zvezdnikar forfeit a game due to fan issues, with similar happening in a game between Budućnost and Zrinjski in 2011. Perhaps the final instant of note, and that landed at around the same time as the FIFA UEFA intervention, came in late 2011, as a ban on away fans for the entire league was enacted due to repeated fan issues that season at games, culminating in games having to be abandoned, including Borac Zvezdnikar, due to ultras fighting in the stands, and the Mostar derby, as Zrinjski ultras entered the field and chased Velez players off it. Even friendlies weren't safe, as one between Zvezdnikar and Hajduk Split had to be cancelled just before kickoff due to rioting outside the stadium. The story of football in an independent Bosnian Herzegovina is very much like the story of everything else there, a heady mix of compromise and controversy. Without compromise, it wouldn't exist. Without compromise, there wouldn't be controversy. Of all the regions in the former Yugoslavia, nowhere is the lack of talent in organisation more pronounced. Bosnia sits with a far higher population than that of Slovenia, yet has far less footballing success than its northern friend, both at club and international level, in spite of being historically far better at it than Slovenia prior to independence. One can, of course, point to a difference being a ruinous long-lasting conflict to blame for all that, but it's lazy to do so. If anything, that's why Bosnia will be the only nation where we have to have a companion piece about modern day things, because so much of the explanation as to why Bosnia's issues go beyond the experience of the 1990s is neatly summed up by the problems of today. The reliance upon tripartite compromise being thrown away, the personalities of those who take a leading role in that, the lack of competence in key areas. These are all issues which bear their rotten fruit after our timeline ended, but all of which are rooted in, and show small parts of, during it. Let's be entirely honest, the decisions that led to them certainly were made during our timeline. Bosnia in 2023 can't be understood without a background knowledge of the likes of Dodik, without a knowledge of how compromise has worked, as we saw when talking about the High Commissioner in the last episode, and how it has been at times imposed upon Bosnia, as we've seen from UEFA on a very specific scale, both this episode and the last episode. 2014 represented the zenith of Bosnian football on an international stage, and in spite of Zrinjski's heroic efforts in Europe, most would agree we sit at the end of 2023 with it more or less at an absolute nadir. So, along this comes a companion episode, episode 82.5, if you will, as it will be, which is just about Bosnian football now. After that, it's time to dispense with North Macedonia, then knock off Croatia, and finally return to Belgrade. When episode 83 comes around, in 2024, we'll be firmly in Skopje for one last look before the multi-episode looks at how Croatia went from Tudjman to Mamic, and how Yugoslavia became Serbia and Montenegro, and how it then became Serbia, Montenegro, and Kosovo. So that is Bosnia almost done from our timeline. Certainly we won't be going on a purely historical basis again. I'd say there will be the companion episode, which I'm planning to record more or less straight after this, pulling an all-nighter as it were. And that will sort of go into a lot of the organisational issues that are going on at the moment. Pitches, not talk about that. And a lot of other things that need to be talked about to have an understanding of the impact of all the things we've talked about in these past couple of episodes. Because you know, if we drop Bosnia off in 2014, you would think that they've generally been really good, which very much isn't the case. Since 2014, they have, you know, been on a permanent decline, and the most recent campaign for qualification for Euro 2024 is, I think it's really fair to say, disgraceful is a good word to describe it. With losing 4-1 to Luxembourg, 5-0 to Portugal in the first half, and other assorted results. But they beat Liechtenstein, so that's one thing. But there are, of course, other things to talk about rather than me just being flippant about how bad they are at football at the minute. So yes, do listen to that. It is put as 82.5 rather than as an ad hoc episode, because it is more directly related to the timeline than any other ad hoc episode I do. So there is that connection, but you know, if you're not feeling Bosnian football, please, you will be able to skip it. So if you're skipping it, happy Christmas. If not, then I'll say that again in the next episode. As always, thank you very much for taking the time to listen. Sharing is caring. If you do think there's other people who'd like this, please do feel free to let them know via your social media channels, be they run by madmen like Elon Musk, or be they run by slightly more sane people. Actually, I'm not sure there's any sane people running a social media company, but if you know of one, please let me know. On anything, it's always at HYFPRW. If you've enjoyed this, please do leave a review, preferably a positive one, on your chosen podcast service. And if there's a subscribey thing on there as well, do that. All feeds into algorithms and stuff, which I'm utterly beholden to, for anyone to listen to this in the first place. Well, otherwise, it leaves me just to say thank you very much for taking the time to listen, as always, and I will catch you next time.